Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Pixel Sift is proudly supported by the Murdoch University School of Arts, and if you're looking for a creative degree, they might be able to help you out. If you're keen to learn more, have a look at murdoch.edu.au/arts to find out what they've got on offer. That's murdoch.edu.au/arts, or you can search Murdoch University for more information. Murdoch University School of Arts, proudly supporting Pixel Sift. Pixel Sift. Hello and welcome to episode 159 of Pixel Sift, the show dedicated to indie games from around Australia and the world. My name is Daniel Lang, and joining me tonight is my co-host Mitch. Thanks so much for joining me, Mitch.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
How are you feeling post-Perth Games Festival?
I'm pretty tired, but still, it was good.
And the show must go on. Our guest tonight is Josh Bush, who you may know online as Cheesiness, the developer of Hive Time. Thanks so much for joining us tonight, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And so we'll be talking to Josh about his new game, Hive Time, which is the base building and resource management sim game featuring bees.
Bees? Let's get into it.
Australia's best video game podcast.
Subscribe to Pixel Sift on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever podcasts are found.
Our guest this evening is Josh Bush, who is the lead developer of Hive Time, and he is here to talk about the game development process. So, Josh, my first question for you is, why bees?
Why bees? Yes, a couple of reasons. One is that bees are really nice, and they're important pollinators. They play a critical role in a lot of agriculture. They have kind of a bit of a bad rap in popular media, so it's nice to have some positive representations of them. The other reason is that my partner at the time and I had a little sort of art blog craft stall thing that we did called Tulof Bees, and so bees were just like this recurring thing for us. We kind of went with that. I think originally the jam that we started Hive Time for, we were going to make a game that was going to be sort of Flappy Bird-esque, but you play as a bat egg, which is an egg with bat wings. And we went for a walk, and she said, I'm not really feeling the bat egg thing. And halfway through the walk, we were like, okay, what if we just build a beehive? And then we started talking about the idea of managing the diversity of the populations, of the sort of generational population that you have within your beehive. And from there, the concept kind of solidified. And by the time we got back from our walk, we were ready to start. And it all came together. Like, the concept didn't really shift or evolve much from that point.
Mm. And for those who don't know, what exactly is Hive Time?
So it's a management sim where your primary goal is to create a sustainable beehive, and you do that by constructing cells for your bees to live in and managing the diversity of the population. So there's broken down into four or five different roles. There's your sort of generalist workers who can go out and forage for resources, but they can also help construction, and they can also man production facilities. But then you have builders who specialize in construction and research. You have bee sitters who contribute to the spawn rate of the population in your hive. There are foragers who are able to retrieve more when they go out to fetch for resources. We felt like the idea of managing diversity and trying to mechanically expose some of the dynamic nature of diversity and representation in the game was kind of fun and interesting.
How long has the game been in development for?
We started the jam in, I think it was at the very end of April last year. The jam went for 10 days, and we had a little prototype, which I've got up on Itch as well. If anybody's keen to see the game's origin, you can check that out. But from the end of the jam to the game's release, I worked on it full time for about 7 months.
One thing that I like is that you have all these different development blogs online, and you're quite transparent with the process itself. And one of them has a big list of different inspirations. From the original SimCity to Dune, Space Base, and that sort of thing. And could you break down some of the elements from those games that inspired you as you made Hive Time?
Yeah, so when we were, I mentioned that we went out for this walk, and that's where we kind of solidified the concept. When we were talking about it, I really liked this idea of having a two-step construction mechanism. So I remember something I really liked about Dune 2, which is like a really early Westwood RTS, was that you had to put down these concrete slabs and then you build your buildings on top of those. But often you would find that you would build your concrete slabs, you'd plan everything out, and then something unexpected would happen and you would have to repurpose that empty space that you'd done. And so that two-step process gave you the ability or a little window where some of your plans could shift and change. And that's something that I wanted to try and bring to bear in the way that Hive Time's construction mechanisms work. So you build an empty cell first, and then you can build a cell in that. And generally, every type of cell except the exit at the moment can be upgraded by clustering it together with another group of the same type of cells and then upgrading them all together. So there's sort of like two windows during which your plans can sort of get interrupted or waylaid. I really liked the original SimCity. I spent a lot of time playing that. I like the aspect of having a relatively simple set of systems, and once you understand them, the game itself is pretty trivial, and the fun comes from exploring the boundaries of what that simulation can handle, which is kind of what I wanted to do with Hive Time. I wanted to have these sort of fairly simple mechanics driving fairly simple systems driving the sim in the background. And then once you understand how that works, once you know how to get the 600 jelly you need in order to create a new queen, then you're free to build the biggest hive or build the smallest hive or see if you can build a hive that can get enough jelly without ever researching jelly production, which is possible. And these kinds of things were a lot of fun. Flotilla was another bit of an inspiration. I'd started playing that just before we started doing the jam, and I was really taken with the way that game is. Really, it's a short story generator with some real-time space combat thrown in. But the idea is you visit these places, and it exposes this very weird and zany and unexpected universe where there are, like, pirate pigs and flamingos who are like kind of these underworld traders of elite technology and stuff, and lots of like just really weird and unexpected stuff. And I liked the way that it implied this much larger and fascinating world. The idea with Flotilla is that you are soon to you're short-lived, you've got some kind of terminal disease, and you're going out to have like one massive adventure with the time that you have left, and so you can only make several jumps before it's game over. But when you die, it shows you a list of all the things that you did, which is kind of a chronology of that adventure, and gives you a chance to reflect on that sort of short story that you've created. Originally, Hive Time was going to have a similar thing where you could scroll back through the events and and see those happen. But we've eventually moved away from that. Another inspiration was space-based DF9, which is a game that I like and loved a lot. If you've played it, you possibly have seen a cheese nest wandering around your station's corridors. I was one of the earliest names to be added to the name pool, so most people have seen. At one point, I got everyone to send me photos of their dead cheesenesses, and I was going to do like a big, giant photo mosaic of just dead cheesenesses everywhere. community turned a little bit sour when that game got released. But I liked this idea of you don't control these people directly. They do weird things and unexpected stuff. And you're like, why are you doing push-ups in a room that's venting, dude? What are you doing? There's always these kind of fun, anecdotal things that the characters are doing. And I wanted to try and express some of that with Hive Time's vignettes and also with the way that you don't control bees directly, but you can watch them and wonder about what they're up to. And then the sort of last primary inspiration was probably Massive Chalice. I really liked the writing and the tone of the writing in that game. Oh my goodness. I've forgotten their first names. I think it's Max and Nick Folkman. I feel real bad because I love those guys. And if I've forgotten one of their names, that's an awful betrayal. But they have a great sense of humor, and the writing they did on that was great. But I also love the way that the events were all about shaking up your plans and giving you unexpected things that you needed to respond to that you know, would not necessarily allow, you know, you never get to make plans that will survive contact with reality. There's always some unexpected thing that happens. So I really wanted Hive Time's events to play a similar kind of role. You know, the simulation's simple and you can kind of grok what's going on without a lot of hassle. But the events are sort of aimed at throwing a curveball and rocking the boat a little bit so that you've got something to respond to while you're playing.
Hmm. One of the most memorable parts of Hive Time is the soundtrack. And what was it about Peter Silk's work that you thought that you really wanted to work with him?
So I'd known Peter for a few years. He was one of our volunteer community moderators on the Double Fine forums when I was coordinating that. He'd watched the progress stuff that I'd tweeted and shared while we were working on the jam. And he sort of said to me, hey, look, I'd really like to compose for this. And initially, I was planning to do the music myself. The prototype that we've got up there has like one music track. Obviously, there was going to be more, but that kind of gives an idea of the space that I was going to be planning to put it in. But I had a chat with Peter, and he seemed to get the concept, and he was interested and engaged. So I was, you know, happy to handball that along and have a little bit less work to do myself. And he just really knocked it out of the park. It's amazing. That soundtrack deserves to win many, many, many awards than it has.
Is it more of a collaborative effort between you and Peter? Or does he kind of just let him go for it?
So I feel like, from my perspective, I'm like, if I'm giving you this work, if I'm inviting you to be a collaborator, it's important to me that you have the ability to creatively express yourself. If I'm telling you what to do, then I may as well do it myself. So I gave him as much freedom as he wanted, but I also gave him as much feedback as he wanted. And from my perspective, I don't feel like I did much, but the way he tells it is that I gave worthwhile and insightful feedback that helped him navigate and move towards what the eventual thing was. You don't always get to see your own performance or your own influence, but yeah, Peter did amazing work.
I think that's part of one of the interesting facets of game development, to the collaborative effort and everyone bringing a creativity to the project that you maybe didn't expect beforehand, because the soundtrack itself is it's really fitting to the game, and it has a lot of like xylophones and it's kind of quirky and zany and fits in nicely thematically, I think. And
yeah.
why was that an important, I guess, design decision to have it be sort of lighthearted and zany?
Yeah, so I mean, again, I gave Peter a lot of discretion here, and he made the final call on arrangement and instrumentation. The very first ideas that we talked about had featured a xylophone fairly prominently and a marimba as well, and we both sort of agreed that that felt like a really good fit. Early on, I said, like, you know, whatever you want to do is fine. Let's, you know, whatever the game is evoking in you, I want to hear. So go nuts and follow your heart. But I said to him that, you know, the game itself is silly and zany, but it's okay if the music is straight. If the music is, because like the idea is that the world is weird and crazy, but it probably has its own rules that it adheres to. And if the music is a part of that world, then it can be straight within those bounds. But if he, I also said to him, if you want to sort of ham it up and make it as silly as possible, then go nuts. And I think we kind of found something in between. It feels cute and it feels approachable, like really approachable, I think. But I don't think that it's overtly silly. Some of the event tracks are a little bit thematically tied to what's going on. So when you're dealing with the slug mobsters, you'll get this kind of very noirish, but also with bongos and stuff track. I love that piece. I think it's called Wasps Are Cops, and it's pretty good. But yeah, so Peter sort of initially, my thought was we'll have some very short stings to go with the events, and they'll be like a positive sting, a negative sting, a really bad sting, really good sting, something neutral, and then all of the musical presence will be in the background music that just kind of kicks off while you play. Mm. But he felt more excited, or he felt that there was more value in doing event specific stuff. And I think that really gives the events a lot more character than they'd otherwise have. So most of the events have a sort of either unique or set piece track that they're using.
And before we went live, Josh, we were kind of speaking about you never actually made a management building game beforehand.
No.
Is that what was that like jumping into it? And is that why you started the development logs to kind of keep track of your progress?
I think I did the development logs because as we were sort of just sharing progress during the jam, people responded to that. And I wanted to sort of keep a bit of that momentum up, but also I wanted to make sure that, for the people who were playing before release, you know, my Patreon supporters and, testing community and other people who were interested, I wanted to make sure that they had reasonable change logs that they could look at to see what was different about. Excuse me. So they could see what was different about the new builds that they were playing. And then, you know, any time that I see a text box, I will drop some thoughts in there and waffle on. So, yeah, it was a combination of just wanting to make sure that I was keeping everybody up to date on what was going on, partly also to create some extra content for my Patreon supporters to have access to and be interested in checking out, and also just to sort of narcissistically waffle on about whatever it was I was interested in at the time, regardless of whether anybody wanted to read or not.
One of your devlogs, you spoke specifically about the financials while making the game, and really a lot about money, which is something that people aren't usually willing to talk about. Yeah, can you tell me why that was important to you to get that out there?
So I have this feeling that if you do something, that it's important to learn from your experiences, right? Like, otherwise you don't have an opportunity to grow, you don't have an opportunity to improve. But I think that works on a cultural scale as well. if I do stuff and I don't talk about what my experiences are and don't give anybody else the chance to learn from my experiences, then everybody else will have to go through and make the same mistakes. And that's the opposite of cultural growth. If I open doors behind me and lower ladders behind me to make it easier for other people to learn from what I've done or navigate the spaces that I've navigated, then that feels like it's being... To not do that sort of feels culturally irresponsible to me.
And just jumping off of that, with Patreon, what made you decide to go on Patreon as a platform to for Hive Time?
I'd started my Patreon thing back in 2015, I think. And primarily it was focused on enabling me to continue making games. I had moved away from a focus on day jobs and had transitioned towards doing game stuff full time at the time and currently still. My main major project is a first-person text adventure hybrid thing that is impossible to describe called In the Snowy Winter's Wake. And I wanted to give people the opportunity to support me and be along for the ride as I made that. And along the way, lots of other work, whether it be smaller projects or contract work or other things. And that was also to support some of my writing as well. Other projects had come up along the way. I got to work on Day of the Tentacle Remastered, which added a year to Winter's Wake's production schedule. And I worked on Full Throttle, which also added a year to Winter's Wake's production schedule. I helped out with Hand of Fate 2, which added another year. And so when we were working on Hive Time and we made the decision to turn that into a full game, one of the key factors there was me looking at which of the two projects, Winter's Wake and Hive Time, is easier to A, get to completion, and B, to market in a way that will attract some revenue to help continue supporting me to make games. And Hive Time seemed like the easiest thing. I mentioned that Winter's Wake is difficult to describe. I can show someone a screenshot, I can talk about it for an hour, and then people will still ask stuff like, where's the text parser? But if you sit down and play it for 30 seconds, that's enough for it to click and you know exactly what it is. Whereas by comparison, Hive Time, I can show you a screenshot and it is what it looks like and it's very easy to talk about. So that felt like I also felt like I could finish it a lot faster. So yeah, that's what led to me kicking that off. I hope that the people waiting for Winter's Wake aren't too disappointed in Hive Time, but obviously they're very, very different games. But both have been very rewarding to work on.
You sound like someone that's moved between solo development and developing in teams with other people. What's it like moving between them so frequently?
It's often a breath of fresh air. I like working with other people. I like working in teams. But then after a while, contract's done and I'm very happy to be working on my own again, you know? There is often, I have a lot of concurrent projects going on at once and often there's a lot of context switches. That's a mixed bag. Sometimes it's fine. Other times I just let one thing or another slide so that I can give something else the focus that it needs. And, triaging how you use your time is just a part of development on the micro as well as the macro scale. I think, when you're, particularly as a solo developer, you've got one item on your to-do list, which is everything. it's up to you to work out what's highest priority, what's going to enable other. And again, if you're working in a team, it's exactly the same things. What's going to enable the rest of the project to move forward with the fewest bottlenecks and the fewest hurdles? Doing that both within a project, but also for multiple projects is sort of the same thing, just at a different scale, I think.
I've got a question here from Yellow Materia. They said, how long does a game take to play? And I think they're talking about Hive Time.
Let's hope they're talking about Hive Time. So your queen, and we'll come back to this in a second, but Hive Time has a lot of options where you can customize the gameplay and change your experience. And when I say the queen lifespan is 2 hours, it's 2 hours by default. You can change that. Your queen will... Every queen will die after 2 hours. But if you spawn another queen, it's more of a sort of continue playing goal rather than any kind of end game or anything. It's basically me as a designer saying, do you understand the mechanics well enough to continue playing and have fun? So yeah, for some people, it's... The game ends at 2 hours. For some people, the game ends when they make their first queen. For some people, the game ends when they're 25 generations down the track and they've seen every dead queen portrait on the back of their throne room. So it doesn't really have an end.
And I think that's probably one of the interesting things too, because you mentioned SimCity earlier and the aspect of kind of this improvisational... reacting to the simulation as it reacts to you sort of thing, right? For example, famously in SimCity, there are like the giant lizard attacks and tornadoes and all sorts of things that can come by and just wreck shop. And in Hive Time, it's similar where, for example, we're watching one of the update trailers with a giant bear claw coming in and sort of swiping at a whole bunch of different cells. And what sort of expectations do you have for players to experience the game within that realm? Like, how do you hope players go through it?
My hope is that the first time you experience these things, they're a surprise. The first time you come across old Bitey, he's a big challenge, and you go, whoa, what the hell is this? But my hope is that after the first or second encounter, you go, there's something that I can do to influence how this... what kind of outcomes I have from this event or any of the other events, really. And so that's more of that same thing of learning to understand the simulation and learning to navigate the simulation. You're also learning the disasters or pitfalls or negative events or even positive events. And once you get familiar with them, then you can continue to sort of work along with them as well.
And did that kind of lead into you deciding to add a for-your-own-fun option for players to really go in and customize the experience that they want to get out of the game?
I don't know whether that... Well, it's funny. We think about Old Bitey is sort of the pinnacle example, because it's probably the one that people who aren't necessarily a good fit for what Hive Time is trying to do in that regard... there are some players, not very many, thankfully, but some who are pretty sad about having part of their hive smashed by a bear after they invested a lot of time in doing it. In my mind, learning to recover from that is an important skill that's valuable to the play experience, and then also learning how to avoid the negative outcomes of that event is part of the game as well. For anybody who wants to turn that off, the ability isn't there just yet, but this morning I added an option that'll be in the next patch that lets you do that. But I think back to... I used to play a lot of StarCraft. Maybe not a lot, but I used to play a reasonable amount of StarCraft. A healthy amount. You know, I slept.
I did say to Daniel, I was like, this game really reminds me of StarCraft, except I don't have to confront anybody in this game, which is like so great.
right. I really wanted to avoid having overt conflict for you to deal with. The disasters that happen kind of happen, and you don't really need to manage any conflict aside from... Or at least the conflicts that you do manage, typically it's diplomatic. Your interactions are diplomatic rather than warlike. But I think back to StarCraft, and my stepbrother and I used to play multiplayer games, and we would use cheats to give ourselves infinite resources, and we would just build the biggest hives that we could. completely ignoring the game rules. The most fun experience was just making whatever we wanted to make. And that taught me really early on that if you're having fun, if you find something fun in a game, regardless of whether or not it aligns with the developer's intentions, regardless of whether it aligns with the established rules, that's still valid. And who the hell am I to tell people that they can't do whatever they want to do? If it doesn't cost me anything, then why not? And for the same reason, if you don't make that sustainability goal of 600 jelly before your old queen dies, providing you haven't ticked the unforgiving game over option, the game has it shows the game over screen, but it has a I'm still having fun button that you can press and you can keep playing, because who the hell am I to take your experience away from you?
Yeah, I really like that, actually, that it's really depending on the player to set kind of their own objectives, really going for, like you mentioned earlier, having the biggest hive or the smallest hive, and having those almost self-imposed challenges that a lot of people like to do, especially people that are streaming on YouTube, for example. But I want to talk a little bit about you, Josh, and how you got your start into game development. What made you want to go into it in the first place?
Well, do we do like the Weebly bit where everything sort of fades into a memory?
we absolutely can add in a sound effect later on.
Brilliant. So my family, we got our first computer in 1988, I think. Pretty sure it was 1988. And my dad and I learned to program together by copying stuff out of the back of magazines. And from that time onwards, I've always been making games in some form. And at first it was just stuff for me, stuff for my family, stuff for my friends. In the same way that, photography these days is something that everybody does, and they do it to express their life and express their thoughts and just share things with people they know. That was how I treated game development. It wasn't until I was in college and had assembled a team of people to work on a pair of Half-Life mods that I felt like I wanted to make games that other people, like people I didn't know, games that would be played by audiences of people outside of that personal sphere. And from that point forward, I think I was kind of, always looking toward making games full time. The plan at the time was I'll get another career and I'll become financially sustainable and I'll make games in my spare time. But that's not how it works. When you don't have a lot of spare time, you don't spend it working. Or if you do, it's probably not healthy and it's going to come back and bite you. Which it did for me when I lost the use of my arms and hands for about 3 to 6 months due to a repetitive strain injury. So listen to your body, kids. That point, I think it was 1999, I was working on a Thief-inspired Half-Life mod, which was going to be Counter-Strike round structure where you have two opposing teams, and one team was guards and one team was thieves. Thieves have an infiltration objective. The guards have to actually spot them doing something in order to raise the alarm. And I hear that Trouble in Terrorist Town is kind of similar to the sort of mechanics that we had in mind for that. That was a whole bunch of fun. We never released it. but we made a second mod out of all of the dumb stuff that we made that was not suitable for our more serious game. And it was called Grenades, Snarks, and Teleporters. And it had the Finger of Pain that did one damage but knocked people flying for 50 meters. We had fuzzy pink antlers that you wore on your head and you could ram people with to paralyze them and stuff. We had a Inspector Gadget style hat helicopter thing, and a guided chicken that came out of a shoulder mounted black powder ball firing cannon, and just lots of really dumb stuff like that. And that one got released, and that was kind of fun.
So, what's some of the biggest lessons you've learned as a game dev? Because you've been at it a while.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a good question. I guess all of the sort of valuable advice in terms of being able to succeed at sort of realizing things, not necessarily succeed financially or whatever else, but actually to sort of get to the other end of making things, is to try and have a good understanding of your skills, to try and have a good understanding of your limitations, and to try and have an understanding of the impact of the unknowns that your project has. So if I want to think about a concrete example, Winter's Wake gives you a text, like there's a 3D world around you that you can't see, and it gives you a text description of whatever you're facing. When I came up with the idea, I didn't know whether or not it would work. I didn't know whether or not the gameplay that I had in mind, or the interface that I had in mind was workable at all. And so when I started making the engine for it, I make my own engine, by the way. When I started making the engine for it, I was like, okay, I don't want to get bogged down in writing a raycasting system because my maths brain is tiny and that's a lot of work. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the graphics card for the last frame back. I'm going to work out what color the middle pixel is. I'm going to color everything unique, and whatever that color is, that's what you're looking at. And that allowed me to erase a very big, because I didn't know how long it was going to take me to write a raycasting system because I'd never done anything like that before. But doing that very quick and dirty implementation of that feature allowed me to get the rest of the game engine up to a point where I could assess whether or not the concept worked at all before I invested a huge amount of time in an unknown thing. So if you can find ways to navigate unknowns and set boundaries on the impact that they can have on your project, navigating your project to completion becomes a lot easier to manage.
And that's a really good answer. I love that. Earlier, you spoke a lot about contributing to the culture. How would you define that culture?
Like game development culture?
Yeah.
Yeah, like putting all the development logs for people to see and learning from your experiences developing Hive Time and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I feel like the audience for that, I have a rule that I give myself whenever I'm writing, which is that my primary audience should be historians 60 years in the future who want a deep dive on whatever it is that I care about. and that way it doesn't matter
that's
if anybody
why we
reads
do this
it
show.
Now or not. Right?
Archiving as we go along, so.
Exactly. But I also feel like there's a lot of knowledge and a lot of learning that is easier to come by for experienced people. And it's my hope that by talking about my experiences and showing the paths that I've trodden and the ways that I've gotten to where I've gotten, that some of that information, some of that knowledge and experience might be accessible to people outside of the industry and outside of that existing experience bubble. So I suppose that the culture that I'm hoping to elevate is people outside of game development
Interesting.
Who might want to get into it.
So more so the people that are thinking about getting into game development and then learning from you and your experiences for that and kind of giving them expectations, I suppose, of going into it and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I suppose. Just I figure that any information you can have that informs or gives you some ability to identify pitfalls that you might be coming up against or opportunities that you might otherwise not see. I feel like that, you know, you still make your own choices as you go along, but if you've got a little bit more awareness of the surroundings as you go, you're less likely to trip over a branch, you know?
Mm. I think we have time for one last question, and we can piggyback off of that, actually. What advice would you give to people that are thinking about going into game development in today's climate?
The industry is very volatile and very difficult to navigate from a financial success perspective. it's probably best to, you hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. Do what you can to make sure that you're not, I recommend against mortgaging your house to get a project shipped. if you can find partners who are experienced with navigating this stuff, work with them. If you can find ways to research and understand things that exist in the same space that you're trying to operate in, trying to understand the paths that they've traveled, but also be aware that every game has a different launch context and every game has a different audience, and you're never really going to be able to predict where the lightning is going to strike. The best you can do is make sure that you're open to opportunities and that you're keeping your eye out for pitfalls along the way.
Josh, I just got to read out a comment that we got from Timothy Mark. Cheesness has been a huge influence and supportive person to me for many years now. He's a big reason I'm interested in game development, so thanks, Cheese.
Oh. Bales, thank you, man. I love him. He's great.
And Monkey Knot said, just as you were saying that, he's Monkey Knot in the chat goes, do not mortgage your house to game dev. And and he says, oh my God, I just typed that and he said it.
So I'm very lucky. And that's another reason I want to write about stuff and make sure that that my experiences go beyond just me, is that I'm lucky. I have access to a lot of opportunities that I don't think everybody else is likely to have access to. I have, I own a house. I'm not paying rent. I owe money for this house, but any of that I pay back, I'm building equity. That immediately puts me in a different situation to other people. When I was making Hive Time, I had the support of a very supportive partner who was happy to pay our day-to-day bills while I ignored contract work and just made my own game. And I was incredibly lucky to have that. I am incredibly lucky to have had the opportunity to work with developers and studios whose work I admire, and to learn from those experienced people as well. I'm like, if I have these opportunities and I can draw some benefit from them, then I kind of have a responsibility to share whatever I can of that.
Yeah, I, for one, really appreciate you putting all the information out there, especially for things that aren't really talked about too much. And I think that it's a great thing to build the community up and increase the level of knowledge within that. Because as you said, it is very difficult, it is very hard, but together I think all of us can add in a little bit of ourselves and hopefully bring all of it up. And
I think just very quickly.
Yeah, of course.
I'm getting the wrap up signal.
No, it's okay. Yeah, you can add a final.
But you brought up something which is about sort of all of us trying to navigate this stuff together, and I think that's a really important point. I don't want to make it sound like I am saying that my experiences are the most important experiences that people can learn from. But if I put my stuff out there in spaces where people are not really frequently talking about things, then that can contribute to the normalization of discourse around these things. You know, it can start a discussion or it can continue a discussion. And that's where the power and the value is in having multiple perspectives, for sure.
Absolutely. I think all it takes is one person to kind of start the discussion, as you said, and everybody can kind of go ahead and share that and their experiences too. And that's all the time that we have for tonight. But if you would like to find out more about Hive Time, you can head to cheeseness.itch.io. And you can also check out Josh's Twitter at Valiant Cheese. Josh, thank you so much for being such a great guest tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's been a bunch of fun.
Pixel Sift is produced by Scott Quigg, Sarah Ireland, Fiona Bartholomeus, Mitch Lowe, myself, Adam Christo, and Gianni Di Giovanni is our executive producer. We wouldn't have been able to make 159 episodes of Pixel Sift if we didn't have the support of Murdoch University. So go check them out, tell them that we sent you, and if you're keen to learn more about a great creative degree, you can head to murdoch.edu.au/arts. That's murdoch.edu.au/arts. And as always, we will be sticking links to everything we talked about in the show notes on our website. You can go find that at www.pixelsift.com.au.
And you can also come join us on our Discord. We'd love to have you there. That's pixelsift.com.au/Discord, where you can share your creative work, talk about topics and games and anything else. That's pixelsift.com.au/Discord. And if you like what we do, can we ask a favor? We need your help to share the show. So tell a friend, subscribe your brothers and sisters, and start someone's journey into podcasting, because we know that getting started is tricky. It's not really that tricky. Just go on your phone, download a player. But once you're in, you'll love it too much to leave.
And next week on the 26th of November, we will be back with Pixel Sift Plays, playing one of the many indie games that feature on our show. That's all for this week. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.
Goodbye.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. At sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.